Here's a little trivia fact. They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Holds the record for getting the most Oscar nominations without receiving one for Best Picture. Now, we all know that awards are meaningless, but indulge me for a minute as I attempt to parse the message being sent by the Academy in this moment back in 1970. It's possible that the film's disturbingly real depiction of human suffering and nihilism, the hopelessness at the heart of capitalism, was simply too distasteful for the voting body to think of it as representing their culture. Maybe it just made them feel icky. Maybe. Except that year, the actual winner of the award was Midnight Cowboy, an X-rated, bleaker-than-bleak tale of life on the edge with an ending just as uncompromising as They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Was it that the film was a period piece? Did this tale of the Great Depression seem like too much of a throwback for rapidly changing New Hollywood? Well, then how on earth did Hello, Dolly sneak in a nomination? The anomalies continue. There's the fact that Best Director and Best Picture nominations reliably go hand in hand. The disappointment, if there is one, usually comes when the movie gets nominated but the director gets snubbed. But not this time. Sidney Pollack got his well-deserved Best Director nod. Who can say why this strange statistical anomaly occurred? Obviously, this is a guessing game and is completely pointless. An exercise in futility, not unlike the dance marathon in the film. In a way, it's a recapitulation of the central theme. What would it even mean to win a competition like this anyway?
Welcome to Kale Your Idols, a new Hollywood podcast with your hosts,
Sam Ludwig
and Elena Gibson. This is a podcast about film. Primarily, we discuss movies, directors, actors, and writers known for their work during the new Hollywood era of studio filmmaking that began in 1967 with Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate, and pretty much ended in the early 80s with One from the Heart and Heaven's Gate. This episode, we're discussing the film They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, which features a cornucopia of new Hollywood figures.
Okay, Elena.
Sam.
How are you?
Oh, I'm good.
It's nice to see you.
Yes.
I don't mean to get right down to business here, but I just feel that anybody who listens to this podcast and has actually watched the film has got to be just burning with a question right now for you.
I think we know where this is going.
How'd you feel about the title, babe? How'd you feel about the usage of the title, the extremely specific sentence-long title?
First, I want to remind our listeners that we do give spoilers for the movies that we watch.
Absolutely.
And this episode, the movie has a fantastic ending. It's really something to experience. And if you haven't seen it already, I highly recommend you watch the movie first before listening, because I don't think you want the ending spoiled for you. And we will definitely be talking about the ending. Yeah. So regarding the title, do I like it or not?
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. This is probably one of the only examples I can think of where I like that the movie says the title in the movie.
Yeah. Just to have this on record, you did recently say that you also appreciate the use of the title in the movie in Love Actually.
Yeah.
That was an example you gave of one that was...
I like that one too, yes.
You know, that was pretty decent.
I did.
So puzzle over that, if you will, listeners. But what do you like about it?
What I really like is that the title is so mysterious and it doesn't really make sense until you see the movie. Mm-hmm. I think if I had paused the movie in the middle and thought, oh, based on the title, where is this going? Maybe I would have guessed the ending.
They show the horse getting shot at the beginning. Did you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah,
but what's great about the movie is it sucks you into the world of the dance marathon and it just pulls you along from one thing to the next so easily. There's so much entertaining stuff happening on screen that you don't really find yourself bored and thinking about the title. So I completely forgot about the title and the opening until I got all the way to the end and it pulls it all back together. It has that amazing ending and hits you with that line.
Yeah.
And it's, there's lots to think about with that line.
There is. And we're going to talk about it very seriously. But I do have to say, so this is my second time watching the movie. I've only seen it twice.
Mm-hmm.
Held up great. This is a movie that stuck with me hard. I feel like it's always just basically been there whole in my brain. Like, I remember almost all of the major things that happen in it, you know? And it just has that power.
Yeah.
I kind of want to get into, at some point, that ephemeral stickiness that the movie has versus maybe a certain amount of, I don't know, like, it is entertaining, but at the same time, it's also, like, very repetitive, and you're aware of how repetitive it is, but you're like, I'm not bored by this, and it's got strange pacing because as the movie goes on, the characters get more and more tired, and they speak slower and slower, and, you know, the terminal point of the plot seems further and further away. But this time watching it, the ending line... So can we just say... You want to say what happens?
Yeah.
Can you sum up the ending?
Yeah. So Gloria and Robert are competing in a dance competition together. They just met before the dance competition starts. By the end of the movie, they had been competing together for... How long was it?
It's several months.
Yeah.
A dance marathon. A quick thing on what a dance marathon is. This is it's apparently an ancient practice that people did that in the 1930s got turned into this bizarre contest where they would just pit all of these desperate poor people against each other. And the contest is, can you stay on your feet dancing, you know, more or less continuously all day long with 10-minute breaks at a certain point for days upon days upon weeks upon months until you're physically exhausted? They're wearing them to the bone. So it's testing the sort of the limits of human exhaustion.
I did not expect it to go on for so long. I thought that the dance marathon was only going to last a couple of days. I was shocked that by the end of the film, they've been dancing for more than 62 days straight.
And it's, you're watching people get tortured, and there are spectators here that are like sort of betting, or they're pulling for their favorite, you know, person in the race. It's kind of a sports movie in a weird way. But anyways, so you get to the end of the contest. It has a reliably depressing end.
Yeah, they realize, Gloria realizes that even if you win the cash prize they were promised, it's not nearly as much as they say they're going to give you, because they're going to charge you for lodging and food and whatnot.
Right.
And she basically realizes it's all rigged. It's totally pointless. They quit the competition, and she asks Robert to kill her.
Yes.
And he obliges.
Yeah. And then, you know, in a sort of coda that it's almost tacked on, but it's so great that they make the title out of it, the cops sort of ask him, like, why'd you do it? And he says, they shoot horses, don't they? But what I didn't remember was this time was like, that scene is so funnily written and acted that it's almost like they're prompting him to say the line and he keeps not saying it. Like, they're like, ah, kid, what happened here? Why did you shoot her? And he's like, oh, she asked me to. And they're like, yeah, but is there anything else maybe you would say in regards to your motivation here, kid? Any sort of statements or maxims you might, sort of spout in regard? Somebody asked you about this, you know?
I do love that once he says it, there's like this big loud sound that happens immediately of the door shutting, if I recall. And it's just so rushed after that. Like, as soon as it gets out of his mouth, they shoot horses, don't they? They're like, and scene's over, moving on to the next thing.
It reminds me of the end of Act One of Dreamgirls, how at the end of, and I'm telling you, I'm not going, and they smash cut back to their, you know, Vegas act or whatever they're doing. Anyway.
Yes, we all remember
it only
Dream
reminded
Girls.
Me of that just now when we were talking about it. I wasn't thinking about Dreamgirls when we were watching the movie. Actually, I kind of did a little bit, because this is one of the contest movies of all time. And Dreamgirls opens with that whole extended sequence that's a, you know, it's a Showtime, it's an Apollo talent show.
You remember Dreamgirls way better than I do.
Well, Dreamgirls is great. It's got a great act one. But so I was thinking about this, like, this is probably number one all time contest movie where, like, the whole movie is a contest, right? It's pretty much the whole thing.
Any sports film.
No, but it's one, they do one, it's like no sports movies are like one game the
whole
time. That's
true.
You know, like,
it is very impressive that it's all within the world of this single event.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess Slumdog Millionaire is a version of that.
Yeah, but then all those flashbacks take you out of it.
Yeah, it's not exactly.
So it spends most of the film not in the movie. What about, Battle Royale?
Yeah, right, totally. Yeah, because The Hunger Games isn't, because that's like a whole first act where
right.
that's, she volunteers and they get wined and dined and stuff.
Yeah, if anybody, any of our listeners can think of any other examples of entire movies that take place within one single event, let us know. Yeah. I can't really think of any others off the top of my head.
No, I can't. But yeah, I mean, this is, it's kind of a bottle episode. It's a movie that's all contained in one place.
Which is why it was super fun when Gilmore Girls did their own They Shoot Gilmores, Don't They? Episode.
Oh, yeah. I mean, which we watched in preparation for this.
Lovely episode. Wonderful. I forgot that that's the episode where Rory and Dean break up. And then
you said you weren't going to spoil things.
Sorry.
I mean, come on. If you've seen any episodes in season three, you know that Jesse's on the coming down the pike. That's his name, right?
Jesse, yeah.
Jesse, right. Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, you know that, yeah, Milo Ventimiglia is stepping in there. But yeah, it's a classic Gilmore Girls episode. I mean, that show is so amazing. Can we just take a sec? I mean, how often are we going to talk about Gilmore Girls? It's a testament to how cool that show is that they did a They Shoot Horses, Don't They tribute episode.
Truly cool. I mean, it's a great idea for an episode because it's such a fun... I'm not going to say a fun movie, but it's a great movie to parody, and yet not that many shows have parodied it.
Yeah, no, it worked perfectly. It is funny how lighthearted they're treating this dance marathon. The town of Stars Hollow is treating this practice of this dance marathon.
After watching that episode, because I saw Gilmore Girls before, I saw They Shoot Horses, Don't They? I really wanted to compete in a dance marathon.
Yeah, you would love that shit.
So fun. Yeah, yeah, I would love it so much. But I wouldn't want to do, obviously, the downright torture that is these actual dance marathons.
You could do it, though, because you're a runner.
I think I'd be pretty good at it.
You would have a chance.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got the stamina. I can definitely do it. I'm a dancer.
You're a dancer.
Long distance runner.
You don't really have the attitude problem that Jane Fonda has.
No. I mean, I get really crabby
you
when
can
I'm
be depressed
tired.
Sometimes,
but, and I can be depressed.
But you
for
can
sure.
pull through. She's a
I've lived with depression my whole life. Yeah. I know how to struggle through it.
She has. We're talking about depression.
But
in
she
this
also yeah. has lived with it her whole life.
Clearly. The way that's. I can't wait to discuss her character. It's one of the coolest characters in a movie ever, in a subtle way.
But first, I want to talk about just the dance marathons in general. In Pauline Kael's review for They Shoot Horses, Don't They? She makes fun of another reviewer who said, "One of the phenomena of America's Depression days was the marathon dance, which turned into a national orgy of hunger, physical exhaustion, greed, despair, and downright brutality." And Pauline Kael says, "Marathon dancing was about as much of a national orgy as goldfish swallowing," indicating that she didn't actually think it was that common of a thing that happened. Mm. I looked it up, though. It seems like it was pretty common. I think that Kael just kind of got her sources wrong. Like, I think she's wrong about this. It seems like it was common and it was just as terrible as the movie depicts it. Like, the derbies were real things. They had fake marriages happen. They had the sponsorship thing that was real.
I mean, that's straight out of Hunger Games. Like, I mean, like, Hunger Games is straight out of that.
That's true, yeah. And dance marathons were prohibited in a lot of cities after a woman in Seattle attempted suicide after competing and only placing fifth. So, I don't know. It seems like it was a real thing.
This was based on a book that was written at the time. I mean, it was reporting the news as it saw it.
Yeah, 1935.
Yeah.
They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Same name.
Right.
Written by Horace McCoy. So, it is crazy that this happened. Like, I hadn't seen this movie before until this episode, and I had no idea that this was a part of our history.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's crazy to think about this movie being... It's not a metaphor. It's just, this is the horrors of capitalism. It's like Titanic or something. You know what I mean? It's just like, the metaphor is so completely there. It's not... It's on the surface. It's not subtext.
Well, yeah, let's talk about the metaphor thing.
The horse's metaphor?
No, the metaphor of the dance marathon representing life itself. Like, Pauline Kael thinks the script is too heavy-handed with the metaphor. She points out that there's lines such as, "The whole damn world's like one big central casting, and they got it all rigged before you ever show up." And then the announcer at the end says, "These wonderful, wonderful kids still struggling, still hoping, while the clock of fate ticks away, while the dance of destiny continues, while the marathon goes on and on and on and on. How long can they last?"
Yeah, I mean, at one point he says, it doesn't, you know, "Don't worry if you're not first in life. It just matters that you're not last." Like, it's all just like, yeah, that's another truism right there.
Yeah, so it is a little like you said, it's not subtext at all. It just straight up is representing the shittiness of living.
The great thing about that is that it just, it opens you up for the character that Jane Fonda plays, Gloria, to be, she truly represents this grim vision of reality, and she's relentlessly negative. Never for a second does she see any good in the world. She is a loser, and yet she is presented as right. And the movie is like, this woman is viewing the world honestly and correctly.
So you like how strong the metaphor is? That the movie is basically just straight up a metaphor?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like, I just feel like you have to have things be this shitty and this obviously rigged and, you know, life sucks in order to have, to give voice in a movie like this to that sentiment of life is shit. Do you know?
Yeah. No, it is amazing that she can be such a negative character, yet still you root for her and you like her, and she still comes across as very strong.
And smart. Like, she's
smart.
Like,
she comes across as really smart. Yeah. I think Jane Fonda, to me, always comes across as smart, even as Barbarella.
Yeah.
Like, she still seems very smart as a sex kitten. I fucking love Jane Fonda. We'll get into her in a second.
We shall.
So, you like this movie?
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about the Cold Stone rating system, but yes, I think this is a great movie. Really held up on the rewatch. Is it a movie that I see myself wanting to show people a lot of times in my life? Not necessarily, but it's a movie that I kind of do think everybody should watch. Like, I think, you know, right? What do you think?
Yeah, I really enjoyed watching it. Despite the fact that it's depressing, it didn't bring me down.
No, it's fun depressing.
Yeah, it is. And I think because it's a competition.
Yeah, right. And because, it's just relentless. Pollock, Sidney Pollock, the director, he says that if he's looking at his work, his oeuvre, the major theme that he sees is melancholy. He sees there being just essentially a touch of melancholy in everything that he does. Even if it's The Firm, right? You know, there's an extra touch of sadness in The Firm for a thriller and stuff. There's a certain bleakness to people's lives. But Pollock himself says, I'm not really a melancholy person. Like, that's not really reflective of my outlook on the world. So I wonder if it's just a version of, like, seeing sadness as smart. You know, like, because Jane Fonda's character is kind of like that. It's like that version of, like, oh, but depressed people are kind of right, you know?
Yeah, certainly in the world of this dance marathon, why would you want to compete? Why would you want to be part of it? It does seem just cruel and brutal. You know, jump off the carousel. Let's start with Sidney Pollack.
Okay.
So I love this movie, as I said. I really loved it. But I don't really feel like the direction of the movie is the thing that's great about it. And Kale agrees with me. In her review, she says that Pollock is not an imaginative director or inventive, but he stages a big, macabre elimination race scene terrifyingly well, and he keeps the grisly central situation going with that special energy and drive that often make American movies more exciting and more fun to watch than even the best European movies. So I agree that I don't think Pollock is bringing a lot to this movie, but the movie, because it's not bad, like, it takes talent to not make a bad movie. So clearly he did a great job in making a movie that was great to watch. Even though, in my opinion, he didn't bring a lot to the movie in terms of style.
It's an interesting question, right? So Pollock, you know, I've been watching a lot of documentaries about him and interviews with him. And Pollock is this fascinating figure in the pantheon of directors, because there's no question that he's a bit of a journeyman, right? But he's made some truly stellar movie. You know, this and Tootsie, I would say The Firm, too, and other things.
Stellar? I mean, I call them good movies. I wouldn't call them stellar. I loved Tootsie. It was super fun to watch. Tootsie's good. I don't think it's stellar.
I think Tootsie's a masterpiece, but of course, you know, largely a masterpiece of performance and screenwriting, yes. So, okay, but yeah, Pollock's a journeyman. There's no denying that. He's not really an auteur. I've watched a lot of interviews with him, and he's typically says, like, look, you know, I get brought on after the stars to be like, you know, in some movies, I know he works with Robert Redford a lot, but you know, with this movie, he didn't have anything to do with picking any of the leads. They were all on board, you know, Chertoff and Winkler and stuff, but before he got on board. And I know he said the same thing was true of Tom Cruise and The Firm. So, you know, he is somebody who gets brought on to execute a vision. But I will just point out, a couple of things that I thought, you know, he did well in this movie. It requires this weird amorphous mass of extras. That's a complicated thing to wrangle. Maybe there's a lot of second unit stuff. And of course, we should shout out the cinematographer of this is Philip Lathrop, who also shot Touch of Evil, which is obviously opens with one of the most amazing, you know, complex shots, you know, the dolly shot or the crane shot, and then it tracks everybody all throughout it. This movie didn't have a lot of those, and actually, now that I'm thinking about it, the direction in that Gilmore Girls episode that we watched, I was commenting more on that than I was commenting on Pollock's direction during They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Because she does all those amazing, they do all those amazing wonders in Gilmore Girls, but anyways. But the things like the tracking of the makeup development and like how they look and the tone and stuff, that's really well done. I feel like it was sort of subtly, again, a lot of this could be art direction and he's delegating a lot, but he really maintained the tone. And there were some beautiful shots. There was that one shot of him on her back, like when the main guy, he was like lying. It was like their first discussion of the concept of suicide. And it's this shot that you just never see where she's just standing there and he's slung over her back and their face. It's like a version of a persona type thing. But I don't know. I thought that was a cool shot. So I do think that there's some subtle invention going on here, but what you're more thinking about is art direction and performance and just the idea of this movie, I guess, more the direction.
I mean, he helped keep the movie all together. And like I said, it turned out to be a great movie. So
yeah,
clearly he has talent.
But you got to love Pollock in a way because of his presence in the culture as an actor, too. I think that contributes a lot to why people have such affection for him as a director.
You showed me scenes that he's in, mm-hmm. and he is great in them, but because I didn't know him as an actor beforehand, I don't have love for him.
Right.
Those scenes you showed me were great, but isn't it possible he might be a better actor than director?
I think that it's contributed to it. Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is I feel like his presence in the culture, because you know, he's in some classics. Like he's got an amazing track record of movies that he was in. Yeah, I mean, I love him. He gives me a rich feeling. I love his little teddy bear face.
And he was like Meisner's assistant for a little while.
Oh yeah,
acting and stuff.
Oh, going back. I mean, no, he's been in on the ground floor and has been respected as an actor. I mean, he started as a dialogue coach for John Frankenheimer too. He was asked to be a dialogue coach for Burt Lancaster, and Burt Lancaster was like, oh yeah, you're gonna teach me how to act? Like you, he was like, love to give him shit and stuff. He's like, oh yeah, you're like this 20-year-old kid who's gonna teach us some nice acting things. Was sort of how Pollock put it.
But then Burt Lancaster ended up encouraging him to try directing.
Yeah, he was like, you should do this. Yeah.
So. I mean, he seems like a great guy.
Yes.
He was involved in some very good films, but one of the all-time great directors? I don't really think so.
No, I mean, these are all like it's a series of kinds of second best of all time type movies, you know, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't actually seen that many movies that he's directed. Yeah, I've seen this, Tootsie, Out of Africa, and The Firm, but otherwise, other notable ones that I haven't seen are The Way We Were, 3 Days of Condor, Sabrina.
A lot, these are things that it's like, right, like they would be in the back half of a 1,000 best movies of all time list.
Right. Like, you've heard of them.
Speaking of those big lists, you know, there's that whole series of lists that is They Shoot Movies, Don't They? Or They Shoot Zombies, Don't They? For the horror list. Or They Shoot whatever for the sci-fi thing.
I mean, just goes to show how good of a title it is. It really sticks with you.
Yeah.
It's memorable.
Yeah, it's the weird, the don't they part at the end. You're like, don't they? And you're like, oh, yes? Yeah, they do. Yes.
Let's go back and talk about the title a little bit more. Because,
please, yeah.
So Jane Fonda is presented as the really pessimistic one. Mm-hmm. I think the ending kind of calls into question if Robert is secretly even more pessimistic because he's equating Gloria to a horse. You know, that's you can look at it in two ways. One, that he's like, well, people nowadays and during the Great Depression are no better than horses and we're being treated no better than horses. And that's a very depressing way to view human existence. Or in the beginning, you see that flashback of him looking at the horse with awe and wonder. Mm-hmm. So clearly he loves horses so much. So maybe it's actually like a compliment to say, like, I loved horses and we put them out of their misery when they are suffering. So maybe rather than being pessimistic, it's more of just a compassionate plea for assisted suicide being okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, is he supposed to be an insightful character? Is that supposed to be an insightful thing to say? You know, they shoot horses, don't they? Like, I mean, it's supposed to sound like a tossed off thing that somebody who's obviously lost in their own world might mutter, you know?
I mean, is he a character at all?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we'll get into him, of course. Let's get into him now. So this character is as not compelling as Jane Fonda's character is compelling. And I don't even mean this as a negative thing.
I think he's supposed to be an audience surrogate.
He in no way pulls focus, and that's pretty good.
It's interesting. In the book, he's supposed to have more character.
More of an interior life, presumably.
Yeah, an interior life. It's from his point of view. And in the book, it says that he came to Hollywood to become a director.
Right. Yeah. The idea of this person being a director is hilarious, comical. Like, yeah. it's quite, you're like, you want to direct? Okay.
And he's supposedly like very optimistic in the beginning of the book. Uh-huh. We don't really get that. I mean, he clearly doesn't seem as depressed as Fonda, but it does open after you see the flashback. It opens with his face looking pretty sad and depressed as waves are crashing. But
the idea is he's a little less sensitive than Fonda and he's a little dumber, right? Like, he's not as affected by the world. Like, it's like,
right,
when he's supposed to be having this intellectual moment almost with like thinking about like, is what I did right? And like, he doesn't seem worried about the consequences. He's just sort of thinking about like, well, she asked me to do it and why would I not do that? I mean, you just killed somebody, you know? Like,
I mean, the whole movie, he gets convinced to do things.
He's very passive.
Convinced to do the dance marathon in the first place. He gets convinced to sleep with Susanna York's character, mm-hmm. convinced to switch partners. He easily agrees to get married.
Right.
And yeah, and then she convinces him to shoot him.
It's like you're supposed to think he's pretty dumb, but he doesn't really seem like that dumb. Like, I guess he just seems like dumb the way we all are kind of dumb in some ways, too, and can be passive and led along.
I think he seems to not know what he wants out of life, so he's down to try different things. I think he's easily influenced by people, and his decision to shoot her in the end, yeah, I don't know, it doesn't really read to me as dumb. It reads to me more as him trying to be compassionate.
He's convinced by her.
Yeah. She made great arguments the whole time, and he can tell that it's something that she really wants. But
he doesn't want to kill himself. But it's not like she's convinced him that he should also kill himself.
No, no. That's right. But it feels to me like he really feels her pain.
Yeah.
And knows that she's in pain and wants to put her out. But he doesn't
seem... But he has that same kind of dispassionate view of what you would do with a horse who needs to be put out of its misery.
Right. Like, he doesn't seem super sad about it. He doesn't seem completely broken up about doing that for her. It just seems more of an objective view about the preciousness or lack of preciousness of life.
Him saying that line, like, he's somewhat more engaged with life. Like, that's the most agentic of a statement that he's made. He's like, yes, I did that thing. Like, I made that decision. He's owning it more.
Right. He had his own reason for thinking that that was the correct decision.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But this guy's performance, though, it's like, I mean, I don't know of anybody who is more only known for one role in a super iconic movie like this. And it's his career goes nowhere, but it's like, where would it go? What would you see that you... I mean, but at the same time, it's like, I don't know. Like, he's got an interesting look. I'll tell you the weird thing. He looks so much like Peter Fonda. Don't you think?
A little bit.
They kind of have that same profile. Like, I feel like they were...
Yeah, Warren Beatty was considered for the role. And it's really hard to think about how this movie would be different if Beatty was playing that role. That would obviously be a much more dynamic character. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't seem as empty of a character. And I truly don't know which version would be better. Like, I like how Robert functions in the movie. Kale says she wishes Robert was more defined because otherwise we don't know how to make sense of his decision at the end. I totally disagree.
It makes total sense.
I like that there's an unknowability to some degree about Robert and his decision. Like, we can talk through this, but he gives one single line, like, they shoot. I mean, he says, she asked me to also. But there will always be this question of, like, is he stupid? Is he just really compassionate? Like, what exactly does he think? And I like that about the movie.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I just realized another fucking intra-Fonda connection. So, you know, Henry Fonda played Tom Joad in The Grapes of Wrath.
Okay.
Her father, Jane Fonda's father.
Yeah.
And this is sort of, I mean, this is like her modern next generation statement on the Depression. It's like, you know, Tom Joad in The Grapes of Wrath is like, you'll find me fighting for the little guy. I'll always be there. And I'm never going to give up. And, you know, I'll do this. And hers is like, fucking kill me. Please. I can't shoot myself. Could you please shoot me? Please.
The Fondas are such a gift to the world.
Yeah. Yeah. But I wonder if that's part of the, because this is still, we're still defining Jane Fonda in a lot of ways. It's just, what a great role this is for her. In the progression of her development, this isn't the most complex role that she's going to get to play. I mean, you know, Sally in Coming Home, I think, is a much more nuanced and complex character. This character is pretty one note in a great way, but
I think it's important to set the scene for where Jane Fonda was in her career. Immediately before this, she had just made Barbarella. Yes. So at this point, she was known as
Nudie Cutie.
Nudie Cutie. Yeah. Sex Kitten. I mean, she was super hot in Barbarella, so I could see why that happened. But she is so phenomenal in this. She said that Pollock asked her for her opinion about the script, and that was the first time she's ever been asked.
Right.
And she said that was a really seminal moment for her.
You know what? I do have thoughts about scripts. You're right. Let me tell you all more of them.
She also said it was the first time she worked on a film about larger societal issues. And she put her body and soul into the role. And it was through this movie that she realized just how much she loved acting.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. And I think that totally comes through in the movie. She clearly is giving her all to this role.
Yeah, it's just such a fascinating character. I feel like it's hard to keep talking about it because it is kind of one note, and that's what's great about it. But she just gets to have all of the, you know, you get to already slip in multiple political perspectives. Like, she has the whole feminism aspect of her, you know, and Bonnie Bedelia.
And her, the feminism in the sense of, like, you should get an abortion.
Yeah, well, but pretty much, I mean, it's, right, that's the thing.
I wouldn't exactly call that feminism, because feminism, you shouldn't tell women what to do either way.
No, but it's more, you're right, like, it's this blunt, she's this blunt object, she doesn't understand what's bothering her about it, but she is kind of obsessed with it in a way, and it has to do with she's perceiving something, right, with, like, Bruce Dern is being very paternalistic and controlling of Bonnie Bedelia, right? Like, and it is because she's like, I mean, I guess it's not really that feminist. It's mostly just she's an antinatalist, right? Like, she thinks we should never be born.
Yeah, yeah. Right? I think that's it. Yeah. I think she just doesn't think it's right to bring children into the world.
Yeah.
At that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't take a feminist reading to that.
But there's something there. I mean, They're talking about the concept of reproductive rights, and, you know, they're having some version of a conversation about it. I guess, you know, I'm doing a reading of it, but, like, I feel that it is there.
She is such a strong character. Pauline Kael feels like she's so strong that it's unbelievable that she would ask to be killed. I totally disagree because I think her asking to be killed in the end isn't coming from a place of weakness.
No.
It's coming from a place of just truly knowing what she wants and what she doesn't want.
She's an outside the box thinker.
Yeah.
Like, she is, like, nobody else is, like, everybody else is too focused on winning
the competition. Caught up in the metaphor of life.
Yeah. They're just looking at what's ahead of them. And she is actually like, you cannot do this.
Right.
The other cool thing about it is There is never a whiff of a romance between the two leads, basically. I mean, you sort of wonder at the beginning, but at a certain point, I feel like it gets pretty much presented like, no, they are going to have sad romantic trysts with other people. They are not. They are a pair of platonic partners.
There's always the question of it, I think, because the fact that Gloria gets upset that Robert sleeps with Alice, like the movie star wannabe, to me, that read as jealousy, like not just that she wanted her partner to stick with her, but just straight up jealousy. So I felt like there was a hint of a potential romance there. But you're right that it never goes there. I still think it pulls you along thinking maybe it could happen. And then it totally undermines it when the announcer, Rocky, asks if they can get married.
Right.
During the show, and she's just so upset by even the hint of that.
And but, he's just, like, vaguely bewildered by it, you know?
Yeah. But Robert describes her as his friend.
Yeah, they are friends, right? Like, that's another thing that I like about it. And, it's again, like, I do feel like she, at the very least, maybe, right, maybe she is kind of into him, maybe, but I feel like he is not into her. Like, I feel like he respects her, but her outlook on life is a turnoff, kind of, to him.
Understandably.
Yeah, like, why would you not? Yeah, I mean, you know, depression, right? This was set during the Great Depression. Do you think there's resonance there? Again, this is an early depiction of, I mean, she is a very sympathetic, this is a person with depression. This is one of the most vivid depictions of a main character that has depression.
I really appreciate the way she's depicted.
Yeah.
Showing her as strong and yet depressed, I love that, and that's bold, and it's not how depressed people are normally shown in movies.
She is smarter than everybody else, and yet she is also participating in the contest, like, most of the time, until the very end. She is not somebody who's too cool for school. You know, she's just trapped, but she views herself as a realist the whole time.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, this movie is kind of it's a multi-genre exercise in a sense. It's subtly true, but it's a sports movie. It's a drama, and it's kind of a musical in some ways. Like there's music. It's, you know, music all throughout. What do you think about the music?
I thought it was just okay.
Yeah. It's so crazy that people were just like fucking listening to Brother Can You Spare a Dime back then, you know? I mean, I guess that's just like, that's the same as like rap music or whatever. It's just like, this is real life, man. Like, they're just like, fuck yeah, that song gets me, man. Like,
I don't even know what song you're talking about.
You don't know Brother Can You Spare a Dime?
No.
Yeah, it was like the anthem of the Depression. It's like the song of a homeless person who's saying like, Brother, can you spare a dime? Yeah. They called me out. Anyways, they play that song in this movie, of course. It's kind of de rigueur, I suppose. You'd have to.
Yeah, I don't know. I just forget all the music in it. It just seemed kind of standard to me.
Yeah? Were you just too blown away by the charisma of the Oscar-winning performance by Gig Young in this?
I did think Gig Young was very good in this.
He was excellent.
And then I didn't know anything about him. And then
you read about him and you found out some crazy shit. No doubt.
Yeah, damn. Like, I...
Talk about suicide.
The first thing I read was this Reddit post that was like, oh yeah, I mean, he gave an amazing performance in They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And then succumbed to alcoholism and, well, you know the end of that story. And I'm like, wait, I don't know the end of this story. What happened?
Yeah.
But damn, yeah, he... I'm sure most of you know the end of this story, but in case you don't, in 1978, 3 weeks after getting married.
For the fifth time.
For the fifth time.
I believe so. Or maybe, yeah, I think it was not his first marriage.
So 3 weeks after getting married to the new wife, the couple were found dead in their apartment, and it seems like it was a murder-suicide.
Yeah.
That Gig Young killed his wife and then killed himself.
Yeah.
It's pretty fucking dark.
Yeah, it's dark. I mean, you know, his life after this kind of was bad. You know, I watched his Oscar speech, and it was very sweet. He was clearly drunk off of his ass.
You watched that too. I agree. He seemed pretty drunk.
Well, no, the famous story about, you know, the last chance that he could have gotten, he could have really launched himself in the stratosphere, was he was supposed to play the Waco kid in Blazing Saddles. And he came in and he tried to do the first scene, you know, where he's the drunk in the drunk tank that Cleavon Little's got to go find. And they said that he just, sorry, honey, he threw up. Like, he couldn't stop throwing up all over the scene. And they were like, what the fuck is going on here? And so that they were just desperate. And that's when they called in Gene Wilder, who gave undoubtedly a much better performance. How could Gig Young have played the Waco Kid, funnily, in Blazing Saddles?
Yeah, no. I'm so happy that Gene Wilder got that role. I love him in that role. So
like, I love Gig Young, but come on. I mean, like, how would that have been funny? Like,
yeah. Okay, so this is a good transition to talking about Oscars, because that's the only Oscar that this movie won.
Right.
Gig Young as Best Supporting Actor. But as you mentioned in the opening, it holds the record for receiving the most Oscar nominations without getting a Best Picture nomination. So it was nominated for Best Director, Pollock, Best Actress, Fonda, Best Supporting Actor, Gig Young, who won, Best Supporting Actress, Susanna York, playing Alice, Best Adapted Screen...
Odd nomination, Susanna York. I guess she's good. She's good in it.
I thought she was just okay.
She's good.
Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Score of a Musical Picture, Best Costume Design, Best Art Direction, and Best Film Editing.
It's crazy that it didn't win Art Direction. What won?
Hello, Dolly.
Ugh. Art Direction's not bad.
I don't know. Looking at these nominations, I can't think of a single one that I feel like it definitely should have won.
No, it's a tough year. I mean, we're going to talk about this year many, many times over the course of this podcast. Of course, this is the Midnight Cowboy year, the first and only time that a X-rated film won Best Picture. Few things signaled the cementing of the new Hollywood era more.
Do you feel like They Shoot Horses, Don't They should have gotten a Best Picture nomination?
Over Butch Cassidy and Anne of a Thousand Days, and certainly over Hello, Dolly.
Yeah, but I could imagine them still, like, hanging on, you know, to the old Hollywood at this point.
But that movie was, like, critically reviled, and it was a big bomb and stuff.
That's true.
That's the thing. Hello, Dolly was one of the famous, you know, like, Star and Dr. Dolittle and Hello, Dolly. These are always the main musicals that people cite as being the big bloated productions that didn't work anymore in the late 60s after The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde.
So compared to Hello, Dolly, yes.
But Hello, Dolly has Barbara Streisand, I guess, which is modern.
But I think They Shoot Horses, Don't They should have deserved it over Hello, Dolly. But if we're just thinking about They Shoot Horses on its own, is it a Best Picture movie?
Yeah, I don't know.
Not like, really.
No, this movie's power, I think, I'm realizing, is in its stickiness more than in the watching of it. Like, I think it's the kind of movie that, like, you just never forget. Like, there's nothing like it.
Yeah, Pauline Kael specifically says it's a striking film.
Yeah.
And I agree 100%. It's striking. I will think about it. I will remember some of the visuals of this movie. I will remember.
You'll remember the Derby.
I'll remember the Derby. I'll remember the ending.
You'll remember the fact that they're doing a dance marathon. I didn't exactly remember Gig Young. He wasn't one of the stickiest aspects.
Yeah. I mean, I liked him a lot, but I could see his character not being quite as memorable.
Apparently, Al Lewis, who played his, like, friend, who is the Grandpa Munster on The Munsters, he was saying the whole time, he's like, you're gonna get an Oscar nomination for this. And he's like, and then he won the award.
What does Best Picture mean to you? Because, so this movie, I think, is great, but I don't think it really deserves a Best Picture nomination. To me, Best Picture kind of means there's a bigness to it.
Yeah.
Like, this movie feels a little too small and enclosed for a Best Picture.
In a way, it is one of the most epically designed, like, single space movies that I can think of.
Right.
You know?
But the fact that it still all takes place within a single space,
I guess maybe that is kind of a big part of it. That's that keeps the smallness. And the fact that, yes, it's so repetitive. Like, it is just, it's one event that you're basically, one stretched out event that you're watching the whole time.
In the beginning, I was like, how are they possibly going to keep this entertaining? And then I realized that the trick that they do is quite a lot of the movie happens in the 10-minute break moments. So they're not dancing as much as you think that they will be.
And also, it is entertaining to watch them get zombified
as
the movie is happening. And, like, their makeup is quite exaggerated, but it still feels kind of real.
And apparently they filmed it in order.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
So that they could progressively seem more and more tired and more lived in.
Yeah. I'll tell you what it sort of was making me think of this time, and I actually really wouldn't be surprised if there was some influence here, is Exterminating Angel.
Because it's like the futile event that they're taking place.
It's all in one room. There, it becomes this kind of society, like they can't escape. You know, the idea of like when he like looks at the sky and stuff. And there's also just like these little parts where like somebody steals away and like goes in the closet or just finds a little corner and you're just seeing this little pocket of life within this ecosystem.
So that's interesting because the book, They Shoot Horses, Don't They, written in 1935, it was initially dismissed in America as just a Penny Dreadful book, but it gained quite a following in France amongst the existentialists, and some consider it to be one of the founders of French existentialism.
Yeah,
because it actually came out before Sartre's Nausea and Camus' The Stranger, and Simone de Beauvoir, probably butchering her name, she's a French writer, philosopher, and existentialist, calls the novel the first existentialist novel to have appeared in America. And McCoy, the author of the book, himself claims that he founded existentialism and says that he has letters from Sartre and other French existentialists to prove it. So with their interpretation of the book, it has an absurdist quality that accompanies existentialism. And that is definitely connects to Exterminating Angel, like the absurd quality that makes you question just human existence in general. And so I could see the connection between the original source material, the book, and then that absurd Benwell movie.
Yeah, and it's just a breaking down, right? Like of people's pretenses. I mean, like the people in They Shoot Horses, Don't They, are already at close to a breaking point in a way. Whereas the hoity-toity people in Exterminating Angel really have quite a long fall ahead of them, but.
Yeah, I do feel like if there was an absurd quality in the book, a little bit of that is lost in the movie.
That's what people say, is there's a certain quality of the book that, yeah.
Charlie Chaplin was originally planning on developing this into a movie. It makes me wonder how it would be different if he had... I think he would have been a producer, but I'm sure he would have had a large hand in how the movie would have come out in the end. And I bet if Chaplin had made it, it might have had more of that tragic comedy, absurd, Kafka-esque quality.
Yeah, yeah. Kafka-esque is the word. It's funny because this movie is trying to entertain you, but it's definitely not trying to use the mechanics of watching people dance in a dance marathon to entertain you. It's entertaining you with the story and the characters, but like there are musical versions of dance marathons in general. There's a musical called State Fair that I'm pretty sure depicts a dance marathon. But there's also a musical of They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Which I haven't seen.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know some people who were in it, and they were like, it's interesting. But you know, there's a certain amount of... You could imagine finding the dance marathon spectacle actually entrancing as a viewer, like the people, like the spectators in the thing do. And the movie is really not trying to glamorize... The movie has no interest in making you entertained by the people's dancing.
Well,
you know,
I think that they couldn't because they don't actually do that much like dancing.
No, but even when they have like Red Buttons come out and do his stuff, it's like it's not great, you know, like.
Yeah, but it makes sense that the competitors would want to conserve their energy. So even when you have like a Red Button situation, you still know that they're holding back to some degree. I don't know. It's not that interesting watching people like shuffle most of the time.
Yeah, but you would assume that there is a certain built-in like, okay, well, we got to have a little bit of dancing, right? It's a dancing thing, but it's this movie. There's a shockingly small amount of cinematic dancing in this movie, in a way.
The metaphor is so poignant that dancing should be a really joyful
thing. Yeah.
It should be fun, it should be exciting, it should be amazing, and in this movie it's just not. Like, the dancing is soulless and empty.
Right, they hate it so much. And just, like, it's like their bodies are this tool that they have to use, but that is also betraying them simultaneously the whole time. And so it's making them hate themselves more and more. This movie is so depressing, but again, it's like a kind of delightful depression. I do think it's because Sidney Pollack is holding the emotions of this movie at arm's length to examine it is mostly a philosophical movie. Like you're saying, it's existentialist, and that's kind of where you're at, right?
Yeah, I mean, a depressing philosophy that life maybe isn't worth living.
But at the same time, I don't think the movie shows that. It seems to say like that's right for her.
It's definitely a period piece, also.
Yeah, right.
Like,
I know that
the book originally wasn't, but the movie, of course, is. And watching it, I mean, I don't know how it felt watching it in the 70s, but they couldn't possibly be thinking, "Yep, that's how bad society is currently." Like, maybe actors could relate, like, oh man, it's hard to break into New Hollywood. But no, like, at that time...
it's hard to break into New Hollywood.
The doors were wide open, right? They were just letting people come in and try stuff. So maybe that's also part of it, why it wasn't quite as depressing, because it clearly was commenting on a severely depressing time that has passed.
Yeah, it is so funny, these... period pieces, these depression era period pieces that were cropping up in the 70s, because that's when it started being, you know, far enough away in time, and also when you started being able to, I guess, like, lavishly depict the poverty. It's just, I'm just sort of having a moment thinking about how funny it is that people, these people slaving over these, like, period details and trying to, like, this movie looks beautiful, and, like, the way that they dress the whole set and everything, and just these people being like, yes, yes, it looks so shitty and fucked up, yes, I love it. Like,
I don't think this
depicting misery of the past, you know?
This movie doesn't look beautiful. It looks like it was shot in a gym.
but it's just... it's been meticulously created to depict the misery of these characters. It's as if they put as much attention to this. I would say this movie's art directed to the hilt. They put as much attention to this as like a costume drama or so, you know, or like a thing, a story of kings and queens, you know?
Yeah. I wonder how it'd feel like to be somebody from that time period, time traveling forward and seeing on set them like saying like, no, make them look more fucked up.
Yeah, you know? Right, exactly. Like, distress it. But this movie is a good, it's a ghoulish enterprise about a ghoulish enterprise.
Yeah, and you are one of those sick bastards in the audience of the dance marathon watching people torture themselves.
But you're spectating the spectators as well as those that they're spectating. It's like symbiopsychotaxoplasm or something.
Apparently the book has a lot more events happen, a lot more scandalous events. Like, there's multiple murders occur. And I think one of the spectators accidentally gets killed by a stray bullet. And it's just so funny thinking that the book is even more sensationalized than the movie.
I feel like the movie, I've read that the movie, you know, gives a little bit more backstory and a little more characterization to the, you know, sort of the main named characters. And I could see there being just sort of more people that you're vaguely getting to know snippets of in the book.
Yeah.
As opposed to this, like, sort of tight, small sect of people. But it's just crazy. It's like Urinetown. It's like there's always, like, two or three characters, and they're surrounded by 50 people. Like, 50 extras. Like, just imagine, like, the job wrangling the extras on this. I just keep thinking about it.
I mean, that derby scene with all the extras there, the way that was staged.
Running alongside and shoving your stars?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And that truly looked harrowing.
You know, Pollock got in and he shot a lot of that himself on roller skates.
Really?
Yes.
That's so fun.
Yeah.
It was, okay, well, there you go. Maybe he deserves a Best Director nom just for that.
Totally.
No, that scene's great. And then the crazy thing is they do it again, and they make it a different type of harrowing.
Yes.
Like, I like the first derby scene more, but the second derby scene, of course, with Harry Klein, the sailor, dying.
The death of Red Buttons.
that was something.
I remember seeing that scene. That was, you know, there was a new Hollywood documentary that was, I think it's vaguely based on Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, but it was called A Decade Under the Influence. And I remember vividly they showed the scene where the sailor dies and They Shoot Horses, Don't They? It was like an early, like, we showed crazy stuff like this. And they were letting us get away with anything.
Something I really appreciate about the derby scene in current modern day movies, I just got to stick up my ass about this. I know I've talked about it before, but I have a phobia against people throwing up. If this movie was made now, there absolutely would be people throwing up during the Derby to indicate just how much they're pushing their bodies. And even in the Gilmore Girls episode, there's no throwing up that's happening, but they say, like, oh my God, I'm going to throw up or something like that. And so I just really appreciate that they could pull off that Derby scene where everybody looks really tired and worn out, and they didn't even have to show anybody puking. And I just want that, like, you know, that should be a lesson to all you filmmakers out there. Don't rely on puking as a crutch to show that your characters are really exhausted and pushed to physical extremes, okay?
You're so fixated on this, you can't help but being horrified to imagine the remake of this where they do that.
It was just very notable to me because
here we go.
I'm
getting ready for this, and then they don't do it.
Yeah, like, I'm so sensitized to scenes where it's more likely to happen.
Right.
So the second it started, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's going to be one of these things. But it wasn't, and I was very pleased.
It's a revolutionary work. You know who this movie was very important for in terms of their life story and development and the arc of their career?
Tell me.
A gentleman known as Bruce Dern.
Yeah, tell me more about, like, where this falls in his career.
Right, so I watched this amazing appearance of Bruce Dern on Dick Cavett, which, just, God, every time you watch an episode of Cavett, you're just like, why can't we have this? I guess it's like podcasts, but there, even so, it does feel like he was getting people to be just so personal in such a public forum back then. But anyways, so he's talking about, you know, he's such a fan of Dern. And he'd known that he'd seen Dern in movies for like 15 years. Dern was, you know, in the actor's studio. He's knew all of those people, you know, the Fondas and Dennis Hopper and Jack Nicholson and all them and stuff. And he sort of played, you know, he did a lot of like TV roles and played a lot of psychos. He's clearly part of the basis for Rick Dalton in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And he is in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as well.
Oh.
He just obviously had this turning point in his career where, so he basically, when he was doing They Shoot Horses, Don't They, he was just like, why the fuck am I not playing the lead character in this?
I mean, he does seem like the much better actor.
Of course. Well, yeah. I mean, the other guy's a non-entity. I mean, no offense to him, but it's, you know, it's not even like I felt like that jumped out to me, like he would be better for it, but he is just like watching this and he's like, why am I not playing this? And, like, nobody's even thinking of me for this. Like,
and his role is very small in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, he still makes an impact, but it's anybody can play that role, right? You know? Kind of?
Yeah.
You know, it's just he got it because he was a reliable actor that was a guy that people knew, right?
He weirdly pops in it, but yeah, that role doesn't call for that much acting.
Yeah, so he felt, he was just very bitter based on seeing that this guy was playing this role, and he said, and then Easy Rider came out, and he's like, why am I fucking not in that? Like, I know all these guys. And he was like, he's like, I knew the Fondas. And like, I'd worked with them and stuff. And they like never gave me shit. He sounded like super bitter about all of this. And so he fired his agent, or he sort of allowed himself to be poached to a different agency. And he said they had to not work for a year, not take anything. He said, my agent gave me $1,000 a month to live on. He's like, I paid him back eventually. But they had to wait for the right role to recontextualize him. And he was like, this was... sort of his low point was They Shoot Horses, Don't They. And then later on in improv sessions for Coming Home, in which, you know, the big freak out scene with John Voight and Bruce Dern and Jane Fonda all getting there, he starts laying into Fonda about the bitterness that he felt about They Shoot Horses, Don't They, and her brother not putting him in Easy Rider and stuff as like part of the character motivation. Like, he brought this back up and worked through it on the set of Coming Home with Jane Fonda.
Wow.
It's like, I can't believe, like, you gave me nothing. And just, like, imagine Bruce Dern coming at you with this shit. And just, like, 8 years later, it's like, we're in a movie together, man. We're in a Hell Ashby movie together.
Yeah, I wonder how Jane Fonda felt about all that. Like, maybe that made Bruce Dern's performance better, but it must have been a little awkward for Fonda.
Yeah.
To be on the receiving end of that. Yeah, I mean, he never really became a big star.
No. I mean, he's kind of a legend at this point, but
I don't know. I hadn't heard of him before this. And I mean, I clearly wasn't the most versed about New Hollywood before doing this podcast. That was the whole point of why we were doing this podcast. But I had heard of the Fondas. I had heard of other people from this period, but not him.
Well, we will continue to, you know, delve more into Dern. I just sent you that link for Silent Running because I just found out that was like his breakout role. Like that was the role where like he played the lead, and I never even heard of this movie. Did you watch the trailer for it?
No, not yet.
Can we watch it right now?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, we just paused and watched the trailer for, what's it called?
Silent Running.
That looked like a fucking blast. That looked like a Mystery Science Theater 3000 movie or something. Yeah. I think we should include it in our next movie marathon.
We definitely should. No, but we got to do an episode on that
movie. Yeah, I'm so down.
But yeah, I'd never even heard of this movie. And he was like, yeah, that was a movie that really broke me. I was like, this movie looks like it was made in 1955 by Ed Wood or something like that, man. There is a whole other layer of the movies of this period that we're going to get to uncover through this podcast. That's what I'm really excited about, is discovering that shit. Because, like, I guess that's a B movie, but that is the movie that recontextualized him to the audience and put him in this next level.
Okay, but the levels are all relative, like...
But that movie more than They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Which was a prestige film, and which, you know, it's like...
Yeah, but he clearly had a lead role in that, right, in Silent Runnings, and he has, like, a very tiny role in this.
Yeah. Paired with Bonnie Bedelia. You always love to see her.
Yeah, I Googled her, so she was the wife in Die Hard.
Yeah, that's the only time I've ever... It. Right, that's pretty much, like, her main thing. And it's like, oh my god, she was fucking in Vid. Like, when we watched this, I was like, this is 18 years before Die Hard.
Yeah, so I can't exactly say, like, oh, I always love to see her. Like, in fact, her face creeped me out in this movie. Like, her face during the derby.
Yeah.
She makes the same facial expression in both derby scenes. And it's just, like, I don't want to look at it. I don't want to look at that face.
She's very like not fully formed in this. I mean, obviously, I'm thinking of the adult version of her and Die Hard, whatever goddamn fucking name is.
You know, she's the aunt of the Culkin kids, like Macaulay Culkin and yes. Kieran Culkin.
Right, Culkin. I did hear that.
Fun little trivia.
Yeah, she's like connected to things. I mean, she's like she's connected to the Culkins. I mean, how much more close to the center of the culture can you get?
She was in two Hallmark movies in 2017.
Yes.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen. That's like,
she's just, never that mighty though. You
know? Yeah, you're right. But that's just like such a sad death of an actor to be reduced to Hallmark movies.
But she's been around forever. Like, that's the thing. Like, she's like reduced to Hallmark movies, I guess so, but she's been around since 1969 or before.
Yeah, and never became a star, so...
What did I see her in before? Well, yeah, I mean, I know, but a lot of people never seen stars, but never become stars, but she's in all these classics, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I guess this movie is... Do you think... I guess this movie is pretty underseen, right? Would you say?
Yeah, I think it's underseen.
But it's kind of... People kind of know it, though, don't you think? Like,
I don't think so.
You've never heard of it?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess I just assume because of like the They Shoot Movies, Don't They lists and stuff that it's that speaks to a kind of ubiquity, but maybe people just think that's that.
I mean, I'm sure film buffs have heard of it, but I consider myself, you know, I definitely consider myself a film buff, and I hadn't heard of it before.
I guess maybe it was really more of like, it was in the culture around the turn of the millennium because of, you know, I watched that documentary, it was prominently featured in that, and of course there's the Gilmore Girls thing, so they were clearly thinking about that. It's fallen out of favor in the last 15 years.
Again, if you haven't seen the movie, watch it.
You should. You should absolutely watch this movie. It's a classic, and it is one of those things that there just truly is. It is absolutely singular. There is nothing like it.
Let's talk about the new Hollywood-y aspects.
Okay.
I know we just said it was singular, but there are some aspects about it that make it fit in with the new Hollywood period. And specifically, so this was a movie from 1969. So this is in the very beginning of the new Hollywood period.
Yeah. But clearly drafting off of a Bonnie and Clyde vibe somewhat, right? Like, the people were clearly like, they're down to see some Great Depression action.
True, yeah. People struggling through hard economic times.
Yeah, and just, like, I guess maybe those clothes were a little bit in because of Faye Dunaway at that point, you know?
Yeah, I think the things about this movie that make it new Hollywood-y are just the degree to which it deals with disillusionment and pessimism.
Yeah.
Showing pessimism on screen,
it's the
seems
kind of,
to me, is new Hollywood.
It's the kind of thing that you absolutely could not show under the Hays Code. This, I'm sure, like this level of total despair, like this, you know, this a kind of a sad ending where the character is so sympathetic.
It's not even just the ending, too. Like, I mean, so the ending
yeah,
itself,
her whole movie. Yeah.
Yeah, the ending itself is very new Hollywood. We'll talk about it in a second. But I think a little kind of early on, Robert asks Gloria what she'd do with the money if she won, and she says she'd buy rat poison. Yeah, she hints at suicide the entire movie, you know? Like, it's definitely afraid to engage with just the downer aspects of it.
Yeah, there was a Marc Maron joke, and other people made this joke about, like, the fantasy of suicide that people sometimes, you know, it's like, oh, I could kill myself, you know? And it's like, you sort of feel like she's just very comfortable with that. And you don't even know if she's viewing it as real, and it you don't know if it gradually turns more real, but she's just like, it's the kind of thing that she just says casually.
Yeah, and she's not the only one who's pessimistic about the world. The announcer says that his father was a faith healer, and he played the role of the kid who was magically healed by the father every new place they went. So that's another, you know, aspect of disillusionment and pessimism and just the world just kind of being like a shitty, lying, deceiving place.
Yeah, right. I mean, and of course, just the Gig Young character in general. I mean, he's this phony who is in charge. You're getting a sort of sympathetic portrayal of him. Al Lewis said the reason that he was going to win the Academy Award was people never see Gig Young sweat until you've never seen it like this before. But he's shown to be, you know, he's this corrupt figure of power and authority.
Yeah. So that those aspects, and then just the ending, you know.
Yeah.
I even when they pull the gun out and he holds it up to her head and pulls the trigger, I did not think she would die because I thought that she had stolen the gun from the people who were running the competition and that they were shooting blanks to signal the marathon stopping and starting. So I thought he'd pull the trigger, but it would turn out to be a blank.
Yeah, would that be a, you know, like, oh, you failed at this too? Would that be a strong ending?
It's, I like that she dies.
I love it.
That's my favorite kind of dark ending. Like, I was so down for it. It was such a new Hollywood thing.
It's kind of the plot versus story thing, right? The plot of the movie is they want to win this dance marathon, but the true story the whole time is like, no, she's got to realize what she really wants, which is to end it all.
Yeah, and she succeeds in that.
She is the protagonist. That is her aim, her secret aim that only through...
It's not secret. She talks about wanting to kill herself the whole time, but yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so the ending, the themes it deals with, and then just the people involved.
The actors and director and...
Right. And we've talked about some of these figures before. So Jane Fonda and Bruce Stern, we've talked about on the Coming Home episode. And then Chartoff and Winkler, we discussed for the Right Stuff.
We got to do an episode on them. You know, they're this producing team. This was one of their early successes until they had a string of failures, including like Nickelodeon by Peter Bogdanovich, until they ultimately succeeded with Rocky. And then sort of that became their baby. And they produced a lot of Scorsese stuff, too. But they were responsible for putting together this whole team, including Pollock. Like, they brought all the stars to... They set up everything.
Yeah, we'll do an episode on them, like you say. Okay, can we talk about the flash forwards and flashbacks?
Yes! I was hoping we would talk about this, yes.
What do you think about them? Do you... Well, okay, let's start with... How much do you think they assist in telling the story?
Yeah.
Because Kale thinks they're unnecessary and inefficient storytelling devices. And flash forwards at the time were really unusual to use in film.
It's always an unusual thing, right?
I feel like nowadays it's pretty common to start from the end. You know, like the Breaking Bad. Maybe it's more common TV shows, but like Breaking Bad does this. I feel like it's kind of common nowadays.
There's a version of that where you have the beginning... Or you have the ending at the beginning and you see where it's going and then it just goes back and tells the story.
That's what this is.
No, this has a sort of subtly continuing narrative of the future interwoven with... Well, there's first a flashback at the beginning and then it flashes immediately to the end. Like it flashes from him as a child and then to him, he's disheveled, he's got a beard, he's being taken to the jail.
I don't think the flash forwards start until like halfway through the movie.
No, they start at the beginning, I think.
Are you sure? Because pretty I thought sure. that immediately after the flashback, it just cuts to from him as a young boy to him as a sad young man on the beach.
I think you see at the beginning him going into jail, but you don't know at this point that it's the future. So you just see him and you think like, oh, he just went to jail and now he's got out and this is the first thing he does. That was kind of what I thought.
Let's just pause and watch the opening scene again.
Okay.
Let's settle this.
Yeah. Well, I could have sworn I was right, but...
I feel like usually when we pause to check to see who's right, you're the one who's right, but this time I came out on top, baby.
That was very nice of you to say that you think I'm usually right. That was a nice refresher of the opening. Like, I totally forgot how the weird synthy music and the font of the credits.
I didn't notice the font. What was the font like?
It's like this bubbly, cartoony font.
Yeah,
it's
the music is very, like, lullaby, but creepy.
Yeah. It was a real, like, la, 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 la kind of thing. Except not with laws. But yeah, the font of the movie, it kind of just, yeah, it looked like a pulpy 30s kind of comic book or something.
Mm. Okay, so... But how much do you feel like they help shape the story? How necessary are they for the story to be impactful and for the ending?
Right. Well, so for me, it's like the question is what is a flash forward, right? Is the flash forward saying, like, this is when the story is actually taking place? Like, the rest of the movie is in his head and this is the real time? Like the fact that the titular line is said in the flash forward is like a no. That's reality.
The titular line is not said in the flash forward.
Yeah, it is.
It's said in the present time.
Well, but it's said in the time of the flash forward once we get there in the story. What do you think about the flash forwards?
Can you say that again? Because I think that's very confusing.
I don't know if I'm making any sense. What do you think about the flash forwards?
I don't know. I think that they do help. Like, the flashback and the flash forwards both help. Like, without the flashback, where we see a horse getting shot, I think that line, they shoot horses, don't they? It doesn't immediately click what that line means.
Yeah, you need the setup.
You kind of need to see it happen. I need to see a horse getting shot.
This is a man who has seen hurt. A horse be shot.
Yeah, I do kind of need that.
Yeah.
The flash forwards, they do add a little bit of anticipation of, like, what's going to happen at the end, because he ends up in jail, but you don't know why he's there. In the book, you know from the beginning that he's there because he killed Gloria.
Oh, really? You know that from the beginning?
Apparently, in the book. But in the movie, that's not the case. You know he's there for a certain reason. I kind of thought he was going to kill somebody else on behalf of Gloria. I thought he was going to kill Bruce Dern's character.
Who will do it, maybe, yeah.
But, so there's a little bit of the question of, like, you know something terrible is going to happen, but exactly what's going to happen, you don't know. It adds some suspense.
I also, like, I really don't feel that it's clear that they are a flash forward while you're watching it. Like, I think you just see that he's going to jail. Like, I feel like you are meant to maybe wonder, oh, are we seeing his dark past? Like, because he's such an inscrutable character, I think you're supposed to be like, has he done something really awful in the past or something, you know?
I thought it was obvious it was a flash forward because he says, like, she was my friend. I was trying to help her. So assume that they're talking about Gloria.
I guess there. So, yeah. You've seen it. You saw it for the first time. So I defer to you.
To me, it seemed obvious a flash forward, although it was just so...
Like, I think when he says she was my friend, you could also be wondering, oh, did he do something bad to a woman? Is he going to do something bad to Jane Fonda, maybe? But I guess you
could have interpreted that way. For me, I assumed it was a flash forward and that they were talking about Gloria. But the weird thing was that I did not like how weirdly stylized and fake looking the flash forwards looked. Like, they looked like they were trying to go for a Kafka-esque trial type thing.
Yeah.
Everything had this weird bluish, stark shadows, like, absurd looking feel to it, which I guess matches the existentialism of the original source material, but doesn't match how the rest of the movie is at all. And to me, it just didn't fit, like, the style of the flash forward.
Well, no, it's kind of weird because, yeah, it's like the flash forwards and the flashback, and just any time when they're out of the hall, the dance hall, it has this weird artificiality to it. But when they're in the dance hall, it's this strangely artificial environment that they're in, but it has this
vibrancy
and just, it feels very real and dirty, obviously, and nasty.
Yeah. I mean, I'm okay with the idea that, like, inside the dance hall is the only place where it looks real. I'm okay with that if they didn't make it look so fake. It's like, that's the world looking.
And outside is heaven and hell.
Yeah, like, that's like a cute idea, I guess, but it just looks so fake looking in the flash forwards that it was just kind of confusing and didn't quite fit to me.
I will say that yeah, you're zeroing in on a kind of stylistic swing that is perhaps reminiscent of another Sydney Lumet, where it's like, yeah, you're trying something there, but I don't know if I see the assured hand of a stylist.
Are you thinking of a Lumet movie in particular, or are you just saying, like, Lumet in general? Like, that these two directors are a little similar?
Well, Lumet, I guess I feel like Lumet makes, you know, he'll just try different things in movies, and it's like, he'll try and take a swing. I guess I think of Pollock as maybe being a little bit more conservative of a director, just mm-hmm. going for the right, like the choice that he considers to be the correct one, typically.
Yeah, but I feel like if you showed anybody the flash forward scenes, people would be like, oh, that guy's really trying something, I guess.
Yeah. The direction of the flashbacks and the flash forwards is a little bit lacking.
I mean, I don't have a problem with the flashback. I know it's a little, I don't know, treacly or whatever.
Yeah, Rosemary's Baby.
But I kind of liked it. Yeah. Kale gets super nitpicky about the flashback. She's like, they seem to be hunting the horse, like waiting for it to need to be shot.
Yeah.
And I mean, there is a question of like, are they hunting the horse? You know, so I understand her being nitpicky about that. But then she's like, and did they really need to shoot it? I mean, maybe it just had acid indigestion. I'm like, okay, Pauline. I think you're just,
but no, you're
being
right,
a little too critical.
But
right
no, if now that you're making me think about it, yeah, like the sort of the story that flashback is telling at the beginning, it's like there's the boy and there was this horse and they were in a field and there was his dad. I am thinking it's like there were probably a more economic way of showing. Like it does feel very like, I really need to establish these things. Okay, like let's just get the shots. Okay,
in the book, it wasn't some majestic stallion in a field. It was an old plow horse.
Yeah.
Old Nelly.
Yeah, that would make more sense, right? Because it's like, this horse seems like, it's like they're killing something beautiful, and it's like he's crying.
Right.
In those moments.
I mean, and it's obvious why they did that, because then in the end, when Jane Fonda gets shot, she falls into the field as if she was the horse.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If they show like it being an old plow horse and they're equating Jane Fonda to this like old broken down horse, like that wouldn't, I mean, she's not an old horse, you know what I mean? She's a fucking stallion. Oh, yeah. Running through field of wheat.
100%. It did that, just rewatching that opening just now, it did remind me of The Boy Who Liked Deer. The Barbara Loden.
Oh, yeah.
Educational video for some reason.
Check out our Wanda episode if you haven't listened to that one yet.
And just watch The Boy Who Liked Deer. That should be the next thing on your watch list.
Sam says pretty sarcastically, although maybe not entirely sarcastically.
I would sooner say you should watch The Pioneer Experience versus The Boy Who Liked Deer. Although I will always enjoy thinking about The Boy Who Liked Deer and saying the title.
Anyways.
Oh, sorry, really quick, speaking of actors, her name is, like, Helen Ann McCrary. She was in All the President's Men.
I don't know who you're talking about.
She's, like, the screaming redheaded lady. I think she the partner of Red Buttons?
Oh, maybe.
She's the lady in All the President's Men who agrees with everything that they're doing and just wants to come in and answer their questions, and then you find out that she has no association with the case.
Yeah.
Anyways.
That's fun.
Spotting an actor. Okay, so yeah, this movie screened at Cannes, but was not entered into competition. I guess another sort of weird thing having to do with this movie that's about competition. Do you want to just sort of wrap up here? And I mean, do you have any final thoughts about They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Or are there any more actors we should talk about? Did we mention who wrote the screenplay? Do you have this information in front of you?
Yeah, the screenwriters were James Poe and Robert E. Thompson. So James Poe wrote the initial script and he wanted to direct it. But Chartoff and Winkler felt that the script needed a rewrite and they did not think Poe was a good fit for director because he apparently was too arrogant. So he was fired. And then they hired Robert Thompson to rewrite the script.
That's right. Okay, yeah, so I guess just the last thing that I want to sort of talk about is the idea of, you know, this is this cruel spectacle, right? It's like Gladiators or the Hunger Games. You know, the idea of a dance marathon is especially cruel because at least, you know, when you're dealing with gladiators or, you know, sports people, sports types, they are, you know, strong and they're fit to fight. And the dance marathon, these people are shown as they're just like sickly, poor people on the edge. There's some of them are stronger than others, but you're basically seeing people who are at the end of their rope. I mean, this whole competition, it's like, is it good that they don't win? I mean, I guess it's better for them financially to not win. They decide, right? But do we want them to win? Would there ever be a good version of this movie where they win the competition, the dance marathon?
What I really like is they don't show you who wins at all.
Yeah.
The dance marathon's still going on. We don't know the outcome of it.
Yeah.
In the book, the murder stops the dance marathon, and then the organizers are actually pretty fair about it, and they divide the winnings up between the people who are left in the competition. So the movie made it more pessimistic by having it going on still, and you know that whoever wins isn't actually going to win any real money.
The world goes on without you in it.
Yeah.
You know.
No, it's fun because when you're watching the movie, you think, like, who is going to be the winner here?
Right.
And I kind of felt like it wasn't going to be the main characters, so you're like, okay, it's, I mean, there aren't that many other characters that have been highlighted in this movie, so it's basically got to be the sailor or Bruce Dern and Bonnie Bedelia. And it's fun that it keeps you guessing.
Yeah. You know, I mean, Gig Young, of course, has the great line that he's like, I can't always spot a winner, but I know a loser when I see one.
I mean, who would say that about Gloria?
But it's true that she is a loser because she's got a terrible head. Her head is not in the game, man. I mean, like, you know what I mean? She does not have her game face on.
I guess that's true. I guess if her head was really in the game, she would have agreed to get married.
Oh, yeah.
In order to...
she complained at every step of the way.
That's true.
That's not a winner. That's the, you know... If you take one piece of advice from this podcast...
Man, I am just, like, contemplating right now. I'm just self-reflecting on all of the complaining I did today. Like... I must not be a winner either.
No, you're a winner. The society is different now. We're not, you know, it's not like the Great Depression. This metaphor doesn't any longer apply, I don't think.
Life is great.
Life is perfect.
Okay, so should we do our new ranking?
Yes.
Our Cold Stone ranking?
Plop it down on the stone, mix it up, and see what comes out.
What do you think? Like it, love it, gotta have it, or does it even make the scale?
I want to talk the table a second.
Here, okay.
You know, because I feel like, obviously, we introduced this rating scale in the last episode, and it was great that we went back through all of the movies that we'd done in the past, and that really helped me contextualize what I think these things mean,
mm-hmm.
getting to see them. And it's nice. We mostly agreed.
Right.
When I went back and listened to it, it's, you know, it's sort of us forming a consensus too.
Right.
You know, then sometimes there's some subtle differences, but they all track for me, and not a lot of surprises. But I think this is a movie that's really a good test for this.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah. Wait, before we discuss what it means, should we just, on the count of three, say it, see if we agree, and then talk out why we thought it should be that rating?
Sure.
All right. 3, 2, 1.
Love.
Gotta have it.
Really?
Oh.
Gotta have it for you.
I know.
I'm surprised.
Yeah, it's funny because, as I said before, I don't think it's a Best Picture winner, but it's a gotta have it for me. And the reason is because I fucking love endings like this.
Yeah,
this, you do? This has one of the ultimate me kind of endings. So it's a gotta have it just because of how satisfying that ending is.
When we come out of so many movies, you know, The Graduate, Bonnie and Clyde, they depress you. So many of these new Hollywood movies depress you. This movie does not seem to you got a spring in your step.
This movie is about depression.
Right.
It doesn't depress me, and it's because of what we said. Like, it does keep everything at a distance. I like how Gloria is still a tough character. She holds her head up high when she makes that decision. And yeah, I don't know. And it's about a dance marathon. And even though it's a harrowing dance marathon,
I like dancing.
I still love dancing. And I still love weird competitions.
It's a movie. They're not victims. I mean, they are, but like they're, you know.
I mean, they're kind of victims in that they're getting fooled into it and that they kind of don't have that many options in this world.
It's just so fascinating. Like, you might be right. Like maybe I am underrating it because I'm trying to think because I feel like so often when we are approaching these movies, I feel like, you know, we've often had a situation and maybe, you know, maybe it's just sort of the luck of the draw of the movies we've had so far where it's like oftentimes I'm sort of saying like, I love this movie and you're saying I appreciate this movie more than love it sometimes, right?
Right.
And I when I was watching this movie, I was like, oh, is this one of mine that I appreciate more than love?
I might love this movie more than I appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's just, it's the thinking about it, though. It's like, you're watching, did you think we were going to have a lot to talk about when you were watching it? Or did you, you know?
I don't know. I think I felt on the fence, you know? Because it's a little simple.
It is, and yet it prompts me to want to keep talking about it, even though
we ran out of things to say.
Nothing to say about it. I keep wanting to go over the same points, around and around in a circle, almost as if I'm running some disturbing derby where I am running towards my death. But yeah, no, I do think that this is a movie that I will remain very unskeptical about as far as its merits go. And I think you calling it a gotta have it is enough for me. I think that I love that. I love that.
I mean, thank you for.
But I think it's a love it for me.
You love it, but it's not going to be enough to change your opinion.
I love it, but I gotta have the fact that you gave it a gotta have it.
Well put.
Thank you.
Yeah, like, it is definitely a personal gotta have it because I just love endings like that. But at the same time, I mean, endings like that are an important aspect of watching movies. So I feel like, in a way, it's a gotta have it for anybody who loves movies because, I don't know, a shocking ending is one of the best things about what movies can do. I don't want every movie to have a shocking ending, but I'm really happy that there are shocking endings out there.
It's a nice training wheels shocking downer ending. I feel like this is a movie that, like, teens should see.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I could imagine a lot of teens enjoying
it. Would just be experience. So cool just like have like some Gen Z kid just like become obsessed with this movie and showing their friends like, you gotta watch They Shoot Horses, Don't They.
I mean, it's cool that it's underseen.
What a weird fantasy this is.
Let's just go show a bunch of teens this movie about suicide.
Who could have a problem with that? You like 13 Reasons Why? Let me show you this.
Okay, I'm very anti 13 Reasons Why.
Right.
I just want to say, even though I love this movie, I do not like things that glorify suicide, okay?
This glorifies suicide. It suicidifies Gloria.
It doesn't make it seem like a romantic thing to do.
No.
She doesn't seem like a romantic figure. So I actually don't think it glorifies it.
No, and again, like, it's really just nice how it seems like she, this is right for her.
Right.
Like, it does not present it as, like, we should all kill themselves. It presents it as, it is right for her to kill herself.
Right.
Kind of.
Yes. God. People are just going to be like, oh my God, they approve of suicide.
I love it so much. I love that it says that.
Okay. So to wrap up,
yes.
You are a love it. I'm a gotta have it. You love that I gotta have it.
I gotta have that you gotta have it.
You gotta have that I gotta have it.
Yes.
I love that you love it.
Oh, okay. You don't gotta have that I love it.
No.
Okay, that makes sense, I guess. Okay. Are there any other aspects we need to rate using the Cold Stone scale? Do you want to, again, do a rating of the scale itself? See how it's holding up?
I think...
Why not?
I mean, I don't gotta have the scale.
I'm still a love it on the scale.
I think I'm a love it on the scale, too.
I think you might have been a like it last time.
What?
I think you might be trending up.
I don't remember rating the scale last time.
We definitely did. Anyways, maybe I did, but anyways. Okay.
I love it.
I love it, too.
Great. Great. We're going to keep doing
going
it.
Going good.
We're going to keep doing it, y'all.
Good job, Scale.
Okay. That concludes another exciting New Hollywood adventure. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to Kale Your Idols on the podcatcher of your choice. We would love it if we got more ratings and reviews. It helps us out a lot. And we would also love to hear from you, so please get in touch with us. I run the social media, so if you get into an argument with us on there, you will be arguing with me. Our Instagram is where we're most active. I strongly recommend using that, but you can also find us on X or Facebook. Just search the name of our podcast, Kale Your Idols, and you'll find us. You can also send us an email to kaleyouridols@gmail.com. We want to say thank you to the Illuminator for our logo, and thank you to ourselves for everything else. Please join us next episode, where we will be joined by a special guest, animator and artist Frank Gidlewski, to discuss Ralph Bakshi's animated adult film, Heavy Traffic.
All right, and I guess that about wraps her up. The only thing left I gotta ask is, Peter Fonda, how did we do?
We blew it.